I'm going to go ahead and introduce our speaker, and you guys, most of you probably know him because he's been kind enough to do an ethics training now for us. I think this is at least the third, if not the fourth, and it's always very well received, and I think he also personally enjoys slightly at least the writing the hypos. So, and it's our speaker today is David Silverstein, and David, as you probably know, has worked with the AG's office for a number of years and is very experienced in dependency law, and in addition to being in the field, and I can attest that he is very much in the courtroom. I think he has a trial every day this week, and he had one every day last week, I think, or pretty close. So he is, so when you guys complain about being in trial all the time, don't complain to David. But he has incredible experience, not in just independency, but he's also got a focused, study of ethical issues in dependency. He's presented at the summit and, all over the state on ethical issues in dependency law. He's also been very active on the Juvenile Rules Committee, serving as chair a few years ago. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to David. Sounds like we're all quiet, so thank you very much for putting your phone on mute. Please also, just one more logistical reminder, please do not all start hanging up before the call is over. That is very disruptive. It makes it very difficult to hear the end of the call when your colleagues are asking questions. So please wait to hang up. If you have to go to court and the call's not over, then please have someone from your office just come in and hang up the phone. By 1:05, we should definitely be done. David, I know, has to get back to trial. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to David. I know David will be, this is interactive, so he will want you to take your phones off mute to talk. So just make sure after you talk, you put it back on. So, okay, thanks, David.
All right, thank you very much, Mary Kay. Thank you for having me again. I always love discussing ethical issues with y'all, and in the past we've had some great discussions about different ethical issues. In fact, when I first became an attorney for DCF, I was a DCF attorney for 10 years, typically, and that's why the scenario, I hope everyone has it, and don't worry if you didn't get a chance to read through it, we're going to go through it line by line together and analyze the ethical issues. But when I started with DCF in 1993, my first trial, pretty much, if my memory is correct, was an expedited termination of parental rights. And I'd only been out of law school not even 2 years. Well, there were ethical issues flying all over the place. And since then, every once in a while, there's ethical issues. Typically, what I see is ethical issues come up during trial or prepping for trial, depots, things like that. So that's why your scenario deals with a trial issue. Just want to make sure everyone should have the document that says guardian ad litem ethics training scenario. We're going to go through this scenario, and you guys are going to participate by telling me what the ethical issues are, and we'll explore them and discuss them and have a lot of fun. The other thing things that you should have is that the excerpts from the rules of the professional conduct, which I'm sure that you all have memorized anyway, and I'm sure that when you wake up every morning and you're looking at the mirror, getting ready for work, you got those rules pasted up right on the mirror, and you study them every day, just like I do. Well, actually, what ethical rule did I just violate? Misrepresenting a material fact. Anyway, you should have that. You should also have the guardian ad litem program standards and the standards for guardian ad litem attorney, because they also give us guidance on ethical issues in your practice. Also, there are, I didn't give you a copy because they're real long, and I don't think that we need to get to them in depth, but know that there are the ABA standards for attorneys who represent children in child abuse and neglect cases. So that's also a reference for you. So what I've done is, if you look at beginning of the ethics training scenario, there's not an ethical issue in the first part because that's the names of all the people. But that's a lot of people to be in a scenario. So I hope that I didn't confuse y'all, and I tried to use names as much as possible so that you understood who everyone was. But you can write me up for an ethical issue as far as putting so many people in this scenario, and that's fine. All right, what we're going to do is we're going to very quickly read through the beginning of the scenario until we reach an ethical issue. And I am going to stop when I think that there's an ethical issue, or you can feel free to unmute and stop me when you feel that there's an ethical issue. And what I'd like you to do is indicate what the issue is and whether you have any citation from the rules of professional conduct and numbers and everything, because I know that you all know them by heart. All right. On February 3rd, 2011, DCF received a report that alleged that two-month-old Bonnie Stevens was brought to the hospital at 11 p.m. vomiting and unresponsive. The report further alleged that there was suspicion that the child had been abused. DCF investigator went to the hospital. The emergency room doctor told the investigator that Bonnie was suffering from two subdural hematoma and a bilateral hematoma. A CPT doctor told the investigator that Bonnie's injuries were consistent with shaken baby syndrome, and that someone had shaken Bonnie with great force at least 2 hours before she had arrived at the hospital. The investigator interviewed the parents, Rhonda Stevens and Russell Allen, who were present at the hospital. Russell advised that his parents abandoned him 2 years before with his maternal grandmother. He said his maternal grandmother died and he moved in with his girlfriend a year before. He said that he had no idea what happened to the child and that when he picked up the child at 9 p.m., the child was vomiting and unresponsive. He said that he, Rhonda, Bonnie's maternal grandmother, Becky Stevens, and the maternal grandmother's boyfriend, Paul Bates, were all at the home since at least 5 p.m. Rhonda told the investigator that she was watching television when Russell brought the baby from their bedroom to the living room. She said the child was vomiting and unresponsive. She stated that she had been previously removed from her mother's custody 2 years before due to her mother's drug addiction. She said that her mother had been clean for 1 year and completed treatment. She stated that she liked living with her mother. The investigator went out to the family's home. The investigator found the glass pipe on the side of the sink in the maternal grandmother's bathroom. He also found a tub full of what appeared to be chemicals and different bottles of chemicals and empty Sudafed bottles. The investigator spoke to Becky, who denied using any illegal drugs or making any illegal drugs. Do we ever have parents when the investigator goes out that deny things that are obvious? Of course. She said that the pipe was Paul's and that she would have him leave the home. She said the family was making tie-dye shirts in the bathtub. Tie-dye shirts in the bathtub? Get that? All right. Based on the information obtained, the investigator sheltered Bonnie Stevens, Rhonda Stevens, and Russell Allen. The investigator learned that there was still an open dependency court case regarding Rhonda Stevens. The judge conducted the three shelter hearings all at the same time. The judge appointed the guardian ad litem program for Bonnie, Rhonda, Russell, and noted that Ronald Smith was already appointed as guardian ad litem for Rhonda Stevens in her pending dependency case. Sandra Smith, Ronald's wife, was appointed guardian ad litem for Bonnie Stevens, and Emily Duncan was appointed guardian ad litem for Russell Allen. The judge further appointed Sue Lemon as attorney ad litem for Rhonda Stevens and Patrick Dennis as attorney ad litem for Russell Allen for the purpose of the case regarding Bonnie and the dependency cases regarding Rhonda and Russell. The judge appointed the office of the regional counsel to represent Rhonda and Russell for the case regarding Bonnie. Is there any ethical issues present here?
We're supposed to unmute. I'm not doing it.
Oh, now?
someone has unmuted, and if you speak, you must give me the answer. Is there an ethical issue?
It sounds like the parents that were probably had guardian ad litem when they were removed themselves.
Right. We know that Rhonda had Ronald Smith as a guardian ad litem in the dependency case. So what's the issue with that?
There's a conflict of interest because we've already represented one of the parties.
Okay. So can the guardian ad litem program represent the child, Bonnie, who suffers from shaken baby syndrome?
I don't think so.
Okay. And what is the issue? Can you look in the rules and let me know? Well, how about the rule regarding conflict of interest?
How's that unethical?
What rule is that?
It's a conflict, not when it's unethical. It's a conflict.
Okay, well, let's go with that. Well, what rule gives us direction here? Because we gotta
it's
move.
It's 4-1.7.
Okay, and what is this rule telling us as far as this situation? Doing good. Keep on going.
I think it would be we would be representing people with adverse interests.
Right. Right, and that's A1, that the representation of one client will be directly adverse to another client. Now, how could Bonnie's guardian ad litem be adverse to Rhonda or Russell's? Well, we're going after, so to speak, Rhonda, right, and Russell. They had their child removed, and Bonnie's been removed, and she's been abused in that home. So there's an obvious conflict, wouldn't you think?
Yes.
And then also, as far as in number two, that there is substantial risk that representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibility to another client, a former client, or a third person, or by a personal interest of the lawyer.
Actually, I think that's probably the one that's the more controlling of the two.
Okay, and why is that?
Just because, I mean, the information that we know about the mother, already been a former client. We're going to have a lot of confidential information regarding the mother that may or may not impact the case involving the child.
Okay.
So, I mean, while one is obvious, I think the meat of the actual substance is complained and contained in sub two.
Good. Now, let me ask you a question. You mentioned that Rhonda was a client. Are children in your cases, are they your clients?
That was loosely stated. No, they are not a client.
Okay.
Maybe we'll be harder on them because we already have
a client.
Like we would be harder on Courtney because.
But it certainly is a part. It's a party.
Cut out.
Excuse me. Two people are talking at the same time. Let's just hear from one. Okay. You just mentioned that the program, the guardian ad litem program, is the client.
No, what I said was the program, the guardian ad litem program, as well as the child, they're both parties.
Right. So who's your client?
The program is my client.
Okay. So
you're both parties.
I'm just throwing this out. So how are you acting adverse to a client? The rule is talking about adverse interests of clients. How is there an adverse interest if the client is not the child?
Well, I'm just telling you what my thinking is. I would think that we have a fiduciary duty to our client, which is the program.
Okay, well, good. So how could the program in representing these people, how could that be a conflict for the client, meaning the program? All right. I will give you the answer. GAL standards, your program standards, 2.4 indicates that there's a conflict when the program represents a minor parent and the minor's children. Okay? So if you're hearing that for the first time, then I urge you to start reading those standards. All right. And then when we talk about who the client is, you all represent an organization, so that always implies or involves Rule 4-1.13 as far as the organization and a client. A lawyer employed or retained by an organization represents the organization acting through its authorized constituent. And y'all would have a lot of constituents in this particular case with guardian ad litem appointed all over the place. So what would be the solution to get out of the ethical issue?
According to what he's saying, how can he represent the town when he's representing...
Anybody? What do you do? What do you do when there's a conflict in this situation? What do you do?
A motion to discharge or file a notice of conflict of interest.
Very good. I wish I had a bunch of candy. Usually I throw candy out during my training, and I have it in my desk drawer, and I wish I could give it to you because that's great.
Okay, I'm in the 17th. You can send it in a box.
Okay. Send me an email. Does chocolate go well through the... Anyway, the internet. Anyway, all right. So very good.
No idea what you just said.
All right.
You?
Now, Wendy Hampton, the guardian ad litem attorney, used to work as an attorney for DCF. I'm going back into the scenario. And was the attorney that handled the case regarding Rhonda Stevens. She joked to the DCF attorney that the judge had assigned the whole guardian ad litem program office to the family. She was sad about the situation because she had several meetings with Rhonda to prepare for Rhonda's dependency hearings and had convinced Rhonda to get help for her substance abuse and mental health issues. Is there a problem with Wendy, the guardian ad litem attorney, handling the case? Someone got the answer? Come on, guys. Work with me.
Talking about lawyers now.
We have Wendy. She was the former DCF attorney, and she had some communication with Wendy. So what do you think?
Nope.
There's no conflict with Wendy handling the case?
See, there's a conflict. There's a conflict because DCF was a former client of this particular attorney's, and now the guardian ad litem program is her client, and she has information from the former client that would influence her ability to represent the current client.
Very good. So what rule gives us guidance? The same one, 4-1.7a?
Well, it's in part the current clients and in part the second, or the former clients.
Right. There's a risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibilities to another client, a former client, or... So very good. You get candy, too. All right. We'll move on. During the hearing, Ronald Smith told Wendy that he wanted Rhonda immediately return home to her mother. Rhonda believed that relapse was part of recovery and that Becky just had a minor relapse. Becky Stevens told Ronald that she was going to kick out Paul, who was abusing methamphetamine. Wendy was surprised about Ronald's request and was concerned about safety of Rhonda in a home where methamphetamine was being manufactured, and refused to advise the court of Ronald's position regarding the return of Rhonda to Becky. She told Rhonda that there was no way the judge would return Rhonda to her mother. Was it okay that Rhonda refused to advise the court of guardian ad litem's opinion? And did she have to follow Ronald's direction?
What? You know, this is so convoluted, isn't it?
Okay, well, did Rhonda, if Ronald, the guardian ad litem, says, I want this, does Wendy have an obligation to follow that recommendation? Yes or no? Hands off mute. Let's hear it.
No.
Okay, very good. So what rule in the rules of professional conduct gives us guidance? You said no, so give it a shot. I'll give you a couple seconds and I'll give you it. All right. Well, I will give it to you then. All right. The rule 4-1.2, the objectives and scope of representation. A says, lawyer has to abide by the client's decision. It says, subject to subdivision C and D, a lawyer shall abide by a client's decisions concerning the objectives of the representation, and as required by Rule 4-1.4, shall reasonably consult with the client as a means by which they are to be pursued. So, it says that Wendy has to abide by the client's decisions concerning the objectives of the representation. Is Ronald the client of Wendy?
I hear you.
Yes or no?
Yeah. No.
Okay. So,
every time I want to hear the answer, friggin' plane goes
over. Well, the answer, I heard you, that this about the plane, but the answer was
David,
no.
David, can I interrupt you for a minute?
Yes.
Someone, you guys, please take a moment and look at your phone. It's very, very rude when you're making comments, and we can hear you. Whoever is talking obviously thinks their phone is on mute. We want you to participate. So take your phone off mute whenever you want to participate into something appropriate. Otherwise, please keep your phone on mute. Please. I've gotten like 50 emails in the past 5 minutes, people complaining about this. So please, I'm begging you on my knees, please put your phone on mute so we can hear. David put a lot of work into this, and it's really disruptive for all the folks that are trying to pay attention. Thank you.
All right.
Sorry, David.
No problem. So if Ronald's not the client, so you're in court and the guardian ad litem says they want to do something, you just say, I don't have to listen to you. Is that the answer? Is that how you guys operate?
No.
Yes or no?
No.
In our circuit, they represent the program.
Okay, so if you're outside of court or getting ready to go in court or in court, and the guardian ad litem says, "I want this," and you aren't comfortable with it. Does Rule 4-1.2 tell you that you have to follow their decision? And someone answered, gave the good one-word answer, no. So the programs, what do you do? What do you do to handle that situation? you know that here Ronald is going to be very ticked off at Wendy about not following his recommendation.
Well, I would have hoped that this discussion would have happened before court, that why we couldn't legally support his recommendation.
Very good. You get more candy.
17th again.
All right. So, very good. The thing is, and this is contained in y'all's standards, the guardian ad litem program standards 4.6. When there's a disagreement between the guardian ad litem attorney and staff, y'all are supposed to have a meeting to try and resolve the issues. And then utilize chain of command. You're supposed to meet as a team, try and resolve issues prior to going into court, of course. But if one arises, then what Wendy should do is she should, right when you leave court, set up a meeting so that everyone can get together and figure out what's proper. Okay? And then also, you have also the organization as client for guidance 4-1.13 and B, violation by officers or employees of organization. And the thing is that y'all's directive is to do what's in the best interest of the child. So if the guardian ad litem is taking a course of action that's not in the best interest of the child, then you look to 4-1.13, organization a client. The violations basically means the same thing. Take it up the chain of command, try and correct the conduct, try and correct any violation. All right. Now, as far as Wendy's statement that there was no way the judge would return Rhonda to her mother, is that proper for you guys to, when you're given advice to the program and to your guardian ad litems, to say, sure, we could legally make that argument, but there's no way in the world I would do it in front of this judge?
Proper, no.
So you don't think that it's proper? Is that correct?
Correct.
And what rule guides you in that?
Excerpts on the rules?
I know it's in the rules of professional conduct. Can I have a minute?
Here, I'll help you.
Thank you.
Yes, we got to move. 4-2.1. What it says is that in representing a client, a lawyer shall exercise independent professional judgment and render candid advice. An attorney may refer not only to law, but other considerations such as moral, economic, social, and political factors. So, that may be a social and political factor. What do you think? There's no way that the judge is going to grant your request. Yes? You agree or not?
I don't agree. I think that, I guess it's the way that you pose your statement, there's no way. Maybe something more along the lines of it's highly unlikely or it's highly likely. In the past, the judge has ruled this way on this particular issue, but I think when you say there's no way, I still think that's a misrepresentation.
Yep.
Okay, well, good. But you could see how me, when I did that, when I gave that advice to someone, how I could say, oh, well, I'm just going under 4-2.1 as an advisor, you know, pointing out other factors besides the law regarding my opinion.
Yes.
Yes. So the thing is that you can use other factors besides just the law and the facts to render legal advice. But I think that is a very good point, that the way it is worded, saying there is no way that the judge will do something because we never know what the judge is going to do. 100% at a time. Okay, let's move on. Very good. You're doing great. During the hearing, Ronald Smith told Wendy that he wanted Ron to immediately return home to her mother. Ronald believed the relapse was part of recovery, and Becky had just a minor relapse. Oh, that's the... I got to move on. Sorry. During the hearing... That's where we're at. During the hearing, Rhonda told her attorney ad litem, Sue Lemon, that she wanted to be returned home to her mother. Rhonda said that she knew that her mother has recently been using and making methamphetamine. However, she felt she could take care of herself. Sue felt that Rhonda was not competent due to her failure to see the risk of to living with Becky and told the judge, my client makes an order tennis motion to the court to be returned to her mother. However, she would report to the court that her mother uses and manufactures methamphetamines in the home. Rhonda became upset, stormed out of the courtroom. The judge asked Wendy whether the guardian ad litem had an opinion regarding Rhonda's motion. Wendy told the judge that the guardian ad litem wanted to conduct more investigation regarding the circumstances of abuse to Bonnie before making a recommendation in a court. Wendy further advised that the guardian ad litem was concerned about Rhonda being around illegal drugs since Rhonda has a history of abusing methamphetamine. Judge denied the request to return Rhonda to her mother. Okay, so actually there's two things going on. First, Sue, the attorney ad litem. Is that okay for Sue to follow her client's recommendation by making the order of tennis motion and then spilling the beans that Rhonda would tell the court that her mother is using and manufacturing methamphetamines? What do you think? This is the child's attorney. Was there something wrong with what Sue did?
It would seem that the child's attorney only represents the child's wishes, so unlike the gal, they shouldn't be spilling the beans on the reason why.
Okay, so they shouldn't be spilling the beans, and is that due to Rule 4-1.6 regarding confidentiality, that
yes.
A lawyer shall not reveal information relating to representation of a client?
Correct.
Unless the client gives informed consent. Rhonda's not going to give informed consent, but as a child, can she give consent to disclose the information? Yes, what do you think? Yes or no?
No.
How yeah, I wouldn't. She's
understanding,
a minor.
She can consent.
What's that?
Yes, if she has sufficient understanding, she could consent.
Okay, but she also has an attorney ad litem.
Right, but her attorney ad litem violated the rules.
Right. Right. So, all right. So the other part is regarding Wendy not really saying what Ronald's opinion was, the guardian. So was there a problem with that? So Wendy just walks in the court, she's got Ronald sitting next to her, and just says whatever she wants.
Good.
And disregards Ronald, is that okay?
No.
Okay, so what did Wendy do wrong? Buddy? Well, did
Wendy
she...
Wendy misrepresented Gal's position to the court.
Okay, good. She misrepresented the guardian ad litem's opinion to the court. And the rule that gives us guidance regarding that is Candor Towards Tribunal 4-3.3. Or 4-3.3, yes. And it says, false evidence. Lawyer shall not knowingly make a false statement of fact or law to a tribunal or fail to correct a false statement of material fact or law previously made to the tribunal. by the lawyer. Okay, so that's a bad thing. Because only information that Wendy had was from Ronald as far as the direction. But as the program attorney, can Wendy make a call as to what she feels is in the child's best interest?
Yes.
What's that?
No.
I said yes.
Okay, someone said yes. Why do you say that?
Because I think our standards vest the same right or ability with the program attorneys as it does to the guardians to be able to weigh in on best interest.
Okay. Someone said no. Who said no and why? Can you all come up with your own position as far as a representative of the program? Someone said no. Come on.
It wouldn't be something that I would do. I was the one that said no. Because but I don't know what rules I'm supposed to cite or the program standard, but if I am the program attorney, I am representing the program. However, most of the time there's a case coordinator, volunteer supervisor, guardian ad litem volunteer. We meet, we discuss what our goals are, and it's not my legal position to be in opposition to my client.
Okay. So what do you do? How do you resolve this issue when this is occurring in the courtroom? What do you do?
Ask the court, could we have a few minutes to confer and go outside and we talk.
Okay.
And I go back in and I represent on the behalf of the guardian what the position is. Discuss it real quick. It can be done. Has been done.
Right. Okay, well, very good. You're doing awesome. Let's move on. The judge placed Rhonda and Russell in separate foster homes. Bonnie remained hospitalized. Judge scheduled an arraignment date for 2 weeks. The judge granted Wendy's request that DCF provide independent services in Russell. The directive was not included in the shelter order. After the hearing, Ronald told Wendy that he was unhappy that Wendy did not recommend return of Rhonda to her mother. Wendy responded that there was no way the judge was going to return Rhonda to the drug-filled environment. Ronald told Wendy to immediately file a motion to have Rhonda return home. Wendy responded that there were no legal grounds to file the motion, and the judge would never grant the motion. Wendy soon relented and agreed to file the motion, not immediately, but soon. But Wendy never really filed the motion.
Mm.
So what's the issue with Wendy saying that she would file the motion, not immediately, but soon? Was there a problem with that?
She misspoke.
Well, there may be a misrepresentation, and we talked about lawyers making misrepresentations. but also, what you have is 4-1.3, which is diligence, that a lawyer shall act with reasonable diligence and promptness in representing a client, and also expediting litigation, 4-3.2, that there shouldn't be any dilatory practices that bring the administration of justice into repute. So if a motion needs to be filed, get it filed sooner than later. But that's good that you picked up that behind the scenes, maybe Wendy never even intended on filing the motion and was just kind of placate Ronald. All right, let's move on. Very good. You guys are doing great. Caseworkers referred Rhonda and Russell to the independent living program. Wendy spoke with Rhonda about her options in the program. Wendy explained to Rhonda that Wendy was going to look out for her best interests and that the independent living program could provide her with funding so Rhonda could take care of Bonnie when Bonnie returned to her custody. Rhonda spontaneously told Wendy that her mother had been abusing drugs and that Paul had beaten her when she was holding Bonnie. Was there an issue with Wendy speaking with Rhonda? about the ILP program? Yes or no?
There'd be a problem with her speaking with the client or speaking with Rhonda because Rhonda is represented by an attorney.
Very good. Communication with person represented by counsel, 4-4.2. In representing a client, a lawyer shall not communicate about the subject of the representation when a person's lawyer knows to be represented by another lawyer in matter unless the lawyer has the consent of the other lawyer. Very good. All right, let's move on. Wendy told Ronald about her conversation with Rhonda. Ronald recorded this information in his notes but did not specify that the information came from Wendy. A week later, Wendy received a discovery request from DCF. Wendy reviewed Ronald's notes and redacted Ronald's notes regarding the information Wendy obtained from Rhonda because Wendy believed these notes were privileged. Was there a problem with Wendy redacting Ronald's notes? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. Was that because the notes weren't privileged? Someone said yes, I heard it. So what was the problem? All right, well, let's look at a rule to give us guidance, and then maybe you guys can chime in. Fairness to opposing party and counsel, 4-3.4. Cannot unlawfully obstruct another party's access to evidence or otherwise unlawfully alter, destroy, or conceal a document or other material that the lawyer knows or reasonably should know is relevant to a pending or reasonably foreseeable proceeding. Okay. So, was Ronald's notes, were they privileged?
Oh.
No? Okay. And why were Ronald's notes not privileged with the information that he got from Wendy?
Because, well,
is that Wendy's work product?
No.
Whose work product is it? The Ronalds? There's no definite answers here, so you can say what you think.
Well, what I was thinking is if they were having a conversation, Wendy and Ronald, about the case, and she disclosed, you know, and it came up, I think you could make an argument about it being privileged, but it wasn't some, I would feel more comfortable if it was the reverse, I guess, if it was Ronald disclosing it. But I think you could also make the argument that it should be disclosed because it is material to the ongoing case. I don't know.
Good. If you got a question about whether to disclose, what do you do?
When in doubt,
go to the rules. And
ask the court. You could ask the court. Right. You know, Judge, I have some notes here that Ronald has, but they're based on discussions that I've had with Ronald, and I said they're privileged. You know, the judge can always do an in-camera and make the call on it. All right, let's move on. Wendy noticed that some of Ronald's notes were missing because the notes were consecutively numbered. When asked, Ronald revealed he had left his notes on top of his car and mistakenly drove away. I guess that happens every day. He said that he tried to collect all of the notes from the street but could not find all of them. Wendy told Ronald not to worry and sent copies of the notes to DCF. Wendy did not advise the DCF attorney that any notes were missing because she knew the DCF attorney never reviewed the Guardian's notes anyway. All right, so what's the issue here with leaving notes on a car?
Yeah.
What did Ronald do?
Confidentiality.
Right. So violated confidentiality, but did Wendy do that? Did Wendy violate the confidentiality?
No.
No. But organization and a client, violation of employees, of of the organization take it up the chain of command. Wendy should have immediately told someone about this and reported it, that there were notes missing. And maybe it should have been reconstructed, the notes reconstructed in some way. But that Wendy didn't tell the DCF attorney that any notes were missing, was that a problem?
Yes.
And that is very important fairness to opposing, you know, fairness towards the other attorney. If you're not giving someone something in discovery, you have to tell them what you're not giving them and why. Why not? All right. Then, some more discovery issues. Sandra Smith obtained Bonnie's pediatric records. The records revealed that Rhonda had HIV. Wendy skimmed the records and provided a copy of the records to all the attorneys in the case. Wendy did not notice the entry regarding Rhonda's diagnosis of HIV. So all this comes out. Is that a problem?
Yes.
Okay. And the rule regarding respect of rights of third persons, 4-4.4. And what it says is, in A, in representing a client, a lawyer shall not use means or have no substantial portion other than embarrass, delay, or burden third person, or knowingly use methods of obtaining evidence to violate legal rights of the person. Does that fit? Kind of not. The confidentiality rule. What it says is 4-1.6. Shall not reveal information regarding to the representation of a client, but Rhonda's not the client. So what's the problem? Okay, the problem is that your own guardian ad litem standards talk about confidentiality, and that there was a violation, should be handled as other violations and take it up the chain of command. Next, Wendy received a call from Misty Allen, paternal great-grandmother of Bonnie, stated that she was devastated about Bonnie and that she and her partner, Alice Lewis, wanted to care for Bonnie. Misty and her son told her something about what happened to Bonnie. She advised that Russell told her he was alone with Bonnie and Bonnie would not stop crying. Russell told Misty that he picked up the child and Bonnie's head hit the corner the crib by mistake. Misty stated that Russell had a long history of being violent while growing up, and Wendy thanked Misty for coming forward and said that she would do what she could to make sure Bonnie was placed with someone good like Misty. Misty thanked Wendy for her help. Wendy quickly told the DCF attorney what Misty revealed about Russell. Okay. Did Wendy give legal advice to Misty? Yes or no?
No.
Okay. Well, did she give Misty an?
I don't think she gave her legal advice, but I think she gave her the impression that she was legally representing her by saying that she would make sure that Bonnie was placed with someone good like Misty.
Okay. So good. Dealing with unrepresented persons, 4-4.3A, in dealing on behalf of a client with a person who is not represented by counsel, lawyer shall not state or imply that the lawyer is disinterested when the lawyer knows or reasonably should know that the unrepresented person misunderstands the lawyer role. The lawyer shall make reasonable efforts to correct the misunderstanding. And the other thing is that you guys got to watch out. We do too. That when we're talking to third persons, you can become a witness proceeding, as we know happened here. So very good in pointing that out. All right, let's move on. Bonnie's attorney subpoenaed Misty for a deposition. Before the depo, Wendy told Misty not to reveal her sexual orientation because the judge would not look highly on her, would not place Bonnie with her. Wendy told Misty that she needed to testify against her son or she would never get custody of the child. Wendy told Misty that she would do what she could to have Sandra Smith recommend placement with Misty if she testified. Okay, was it proper for Wendy to tell Misty not to reveal information?
No.
Okay. Is that due to fairness to opposing party and counsel's Rule 4-3.4, and you can't request a person other than a client to refrain from voluntarily giving relevant information to another party, unless the person's relative or employee of the agent or client? Very good. And then also, we got the issue that she's given Misty the mistaken impression that Wendy is Misty's attorney. All right, let's move on. Although served with a subpoena, Misty did not show for her depo. Wendy called Misty and told her, if you do not show for this deposition when it's scheduled, I'll ask the court to arrest you and hold you in contempt. Do you want to go to jail? Misty began to cry and said, you don't understand, hung up the phone. Wendy asked Bonnie's attorney if he was going to file a motion for contempt of court against Misty. Bonnie's attorney responded, she's going to lie for her grandson anyway. I will call her as a witness at trial. Was that proper for Wendy to make a threat to Misty to get her to testify?
No.
You know, the guys know the answer. Come on.
No, it's not proper to threaten a witness.
Right. And that's due to fairness to opposing party and counsel Rule 4-3.4, that you cannot participate in presenting or threaten to present criminal charges solely to obtain an advantage in a civil matter. All right, moving on. Wendy thought Russell should have a psych eval because it would be helpful for the eventual TPR proceeding. Wendy knew that the arraignment hearing would be continued for 2 months if the judge ordered Russell to complete a psych eval. Wendy felt Rhonda was going to implicate Russell since Rhonda was in therapy. Wendy wanted to give the therapist more time to work with Rhonda. Wendy knew there was no evidence that Russell had a mental health condition or that his mental state was an issue. She also knew that there was case law against her position. However, Wendy knew that the judge liked Sandra and agreed to the GAL position 90% of the time. At the arraignment, Wendy makes her tenant's motion for the psych eval of Russell. Russell's attorney objected to the failure of Wendy to file a motion and noticed the motion for a hearing. Wendy knew she did not need to respond, so she didn't even respond. The judge granted the motion for the psych eval and continued the arraignment hearing as to Bonnie. The judge also continued Russell's arraignment because the diligence search for his parents had not been completed. So, was it ethical for Wendy to pursue for psych eval of Russell? Yes or no?
No.
Okay, and why?
She already knew that his mental state wasn't an issue.
Right. That meritorious claims and contentions, 4-3.1, a lawyer shall not bring or defend a proceeding unless there's a basis in law or fact doing so that is not frivolous, which includes a good faith argument for extension, modification, or reversal of existing law. Now, is the fact that there wasn't favorable law, did that mean that Wendy could not file the motion?
No.
No, she's filing a frivolous motion.
No. It's the law, she can make a good faith argument that the law says that he should get an evaluation. But at the same time, Wendy needs to bring that information up to the judge. You know, that's candor towards the tribunal. So she has an obligation to bring that up, that the case law is against her, and just argue for an extension. But there was definitely no factual basis in this scenario. So, and then, of course, we also have the permanency issue as far as expediting litigation, 4-3.2. As far as asking for a psych eval to stall things, improper. At the arraignment hearing, DCF filed a TPR petition regarding the parents. Wendy Sandra, coordinator supervisor, met and decided to support the TPR petition as to Russell, but not as to Rhonda. Several hearings occur in the TPR proceeding. Wendy never mentioned at the hearings or to DCF attorney directly that Sandra had an objection to the TPR of Rhonda. Is that a problem that Wendy didn't let the DCF attorney know the guardian ad litem's position? Was it a problem? I would argue that the ethical issue is on the DCF attorney for not knowing and not asking. I don't think it's a problem. We don't play hide the ball, but at the same time, was there an affirmative obligation? I don't think there was. Professionally, probably should have happened. Wendy should have said something. Then the psychological, we'll move on, psychological evaluation of Russell recommended that Russell have a psychiatric evaluation. The psychiatrist recommended Russell receive Concerta. DCF filed a motion to authorize provision of Concerta. Wendy objected to the motion, indicating that the GAL needed a Medline consult. Judge abated motion pending the Medline. Then a month passes, and still the child's not on the meds. The Medline consult took a month, and in the meantime, he's bouncing from foster home to foster home. Was there any problem with Wendy insisting on the Medline consult for the psych meds? Yes or no?
No.
No. But was there a problem that she sat there for a month and didn't do anything to find out what was going on with Medline consult?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Diligence 4-1.3 in the expediting litigation 4-3.2, and you guys are best interest, so when the Medline is consulted, we need to find out as soon as possible. So Wendy has an affirmative obligation. Can't pan that off or pass that off on anybody else's, as far as anybody else's responsibility. Then Wendy found out that Rhonda had not been referred to IL services, filed a motion of contempt. DCF explained that service provider was in process of changing and Rhonda would receive services in a month. Judge denies the motion for contempt. Was it proper for Wendy to pursue the motion for contempt? Yes or no?
No.
No. And is that because there wasn't a good faith basis, because there wasn't a written order? Is that why?
Sorry, there was a beep. Could you repeat your last statement, David?
Yeah. Is the reason why it was not good to file the motion for contempt because there wasn't a written ordering that the child go to the ILP program. You need a written order, right, to file a motion for contempt? That's a direct contempt in front of the court. Okay, so I'm not hearing anything, so we'll move on. It's meritorious claims in contention 4-3.1. Got to have that good faith basis. And also, please don't file motions for contempt right out the gate. Use the process. Try and get this worked out by communicating with the DCF to get it worked out. All right. At the TPR trial, Wendy apologized for his no guardian ad litem report, but noted Sandra would testify. Wendy waived the opening, didn't prepare to question witnesses. Since there were already depots, she was just cross-examining. Asked some clarifying questions, did not ask questions to counter DCF's theory that Rhonda was a possible perpetrator, and also Becky testifies that the day Bonnie was injured, Becky and Paul were in bed all day recovering from a meth binge. Was there a problem with no GAL report for that hearing?
Yes.
Yes, competent. Rule 4-1.1. That's competent representation. You all got to file the report. Was Wendy prepared for trial?
No.
No. So, again, competence, 4-1.1. So, you guys got to prepare just as much as I did. Missy testified that Russell has always been well-behaved, nonviolent. Wendy asked Missy whether Missy remembered telling Wendy that Russell mentioned that he may have injured Bonnie by mistake and that Russell had a history of violence. Russell's attorney objected due to Wendy testifying. Judge asked everyone to approach. Wendy tells the judge about the prior conversation with Missy, that Missy had committed perjury. Russell's attorney asked that Missy be disqualified as a witness. Judge denied the request. Judge sustained the original objection, and Missy denied that she had ever made a statement that Russell told her about causing any injury to Bonnie or Russell was violent. Did Wendy make herself a witness? Yes,
yes.
Or no? Yes.
Yes.
Lawyer as a witness, 4-3.7. Lawyer shall not act as an advocate at trial in which the lawyer is likely to be a necessary witness on behalf of the client. So Wendy was being a witness, but was by getting this information from Misty, was she offering false evidence to the tribunal? Yes or no? Come on, we only got a couple more. You guys...
Yes.
Okay, well, candor towards tribunal, that you can't offer evidence that the lawyer knows to be false. Bringing this to the judge's attention, is that what Wendy should have done?
Yes.
Yes. It says that the lawyer shall take reasonable remedial measures, including, if necessary, disclosure to the tribunal. The ACF attorney takes testimony of Sandra, recommended court TPR rights of Russell but not Rhonda, then peppered Sandra with questions about her recommendation. Sandra was unprepared, eventually agreed that she had no basis for not recommending TPR as to Rhonda. Did Wendy do something wrong since Sandra can't answer any questions, right?
She didn't prepare her client.
Yes, competence, 4-1.1. Wendy should have met with the guardian and said, look, you're going to get hammered because DCF is in favor of TPRs to both parents. All right. In her closing, Wendy stated, Misty Allen is a liar. She told me that her son admitted to her that he caused Bonnie's injuries. Russell's attorney objected to improper closing. Judge sustained the objection. Wendy also stated, Judge, you need to TPR Russell because you need to choose good over evil. The judge terminated the rights of Russell and Rhonda. So was there a problem with Wendy's closing? Was her statement about Misty's credibility proper, saying Misty Allen's a liar?
No.
No.
I'm proper.
Okay. And that's correct. It's Rule 4-3.4, fairness to opposing party and counsel in trial cannot state a personal opinion about the credibility of a witness. Unless the statement is authorized by current rule or case law. There is some case law out there that kind of lets you, that says that you can call someone a liar, but I wouldn't do it. Also, how about the fact that she said, oh, her son admitted to her that he caused Bonnie's injuries? Something that didn't come out in trial. Is that improper?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the same rule. I mean, essentially, that's fabricated evidence because it wasn't put on. And then how about asking the judge to choose good over evil? Is that a problem?
Yes.
Yes. And that is same rule, 3.4, cannot give your personal opinion as to the justice of a cause. Okay. After trial, DCF attorney asked Wendy why she had not mentioned that Sandra opposed TPR. Wendy apologized. Wendy mentioned to the DCF attorney that months had passed and still had been no arraignment to Russell's parents. Was Wendy obligated to make sure that there was an arraignment for Russell?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. Competence, Rule 4, -1.1 and diligence need to expedite this litigation. All right. After the parents' attorneys left the courtroom, Wendy approached the judge and apologized to the judge for Sandra's floundering testimony and said that Sandra had the beginning signs of dementia. Okay, was there a problem with that? There's two problems. What's one problem?
Ex parte communication.
The parents' attorney had left the courtroom.
Right, ex parte with the judge. And that's impartiality at the decorum of the tribunal, Rule 4-3.5. Communicate or cause another to communicate as to the merits of the cause. Now, was saying that Sandra had the beginning signs of dementia, is that the merits of the cause? What do you think?
It bears on the credibility of the witness.
Okay. So that is the merits of the cause. Very good. All right. And then How about the other thing about telling the judge that Sandra's got the beginning signs of dementia? Is that a problem?
Yes.
Okay, and what's the problem?
That she knew had dementia.
Well, how about acting adverse to the client? And how about confidentiality? Rule 4-1.6. Isn't that confidential information? Shouldn't that be someone's health? Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So we're at the end of the scenario. I hope that everyone had a good time. I hope that everyone was challenged by this scenario. I know that I was. And I just want to say that I really appreciate your participation. Y'all did a great job. We had a lot of work to do that we got done in this hour. I hope that y'all learned a lot. Refer to your rules, your program standards, the ABA standards. Issues come up. Are there any questions for me? Okay. Well, thank you very much for having me, and I look forward to doing another training with you next year.